on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 95-year-old Orville Lewis of Orange Cove, California, originally from Inola, Oklahoma, an Army Air Corps veteran of World War II, recipient of the Purple Heart, and for nearly 2 years, a prisoner of war in Europe. Go to hometownheroesradio.com to listen to our last episode and the incredible story of how Orville recently met the son of one of his fellow Stalag 17B prisoners. If you've been listening to the show for a long time, you've heard quite a few ex-prisoners of war, and sooner or later, the conversation always turns to how much, or shall I say how little, they had to eat. So, Orville, how is the food at Stalag 17B in Krems, Austria?
Be honest with you, rutabaga soup. They started bringing us some kind of breakfast drink in, but it was so terrible. We told them, just bring us water. And when we could get a Red Cross parcel in, we had Nescafe powder, and we take a big can of water and a little tip of coffee and put in that to drink. And we got all the quarter of a loaf of black bread to start with. They finally got down on the end of just a quarter of a loaf to three guys every 3 days, just practically nothing, no bread line. But we had a rutabaga soup, and that was it. Well, they put the meat in it, but one day I went up with Oakberg, our waste gunner, to get to carry the food back to the barracks. He said, look up there, there's three German Shepherd dogs dressed out beside the horse meat that they cut up and put in their soup. So we was eating dog meat and horse meat when they did get meat. And they give us blood sausage, and I couldn't eat it. It just, they raked it, I guess, off a board. It just, hair is so thick, you eat more hair than you would sausage. I wouldn't eat it. And once in a great while, we'd get a dessert of some sort, like barley, sweetened barley.
And when you say the bread, is this the same bread that so many guys have told me about that's more sawdust than flour, or tree flour than real flour?
It was black like wood. Mm-hmm. It sure was. It wasn't real. The German soldiers ate it, but I didn't like it.
Was it hard to cut?
Yes. You need a hacksaw.
And you've mentioned a couple times the Red Cross. I imagine you have some pretty strong feelings about the Red Cross.
They sent us stuff. But, you know, when the war was over, we found a lot. They found a lot of packages where the Germans stored. They kept themselves. We went as high as 3 weeks to a month without getting anything, and sometime longer than that. And then all at once, we get them for a couple of months straight, just once a month. And there was 10 pounds of food in each one of those. And we played poker for those, too. Some of the hardest poker playing you ever saw in your life for that food.
Do you remember how much you weighed when you got shot down?
Yes. I remember when I went in, I weighed 180, and I come out, and when I got to England, I weighed 125.
Yeah, I think people can get the picture from that that contrast, that this was not very comfortable living for all those months as a POW. What were some of the things? We talked earlier about Les's father being one of the guys in your barracks, and I said, you know, maybe you're one of the guys who helped his dad survive. Maybe he's one of the guys who helped you survive. What did you guys do for each other to get through this uncertain and stark and really scary reality?
Well, I don't know as we did any one thing, but we told stories about home, about our schools, and everybody, we told jokes and entertained each other best we could like that. We'd take walks, and we even, till we got so weak we couldn't do it, we played Diggers basketball, and we played a little basketball, and played, I was a softball pitcher, I throwed a game or two and quit that because we didn't have the energy to go out after a while. We mostly walked the compound, and we talked, and then we entertained, as I say, the Barbed Wire Mountaineers. We entertained barracks. You'd go barrack to barrack at night and play 2 or 3 hours, and they had us booked up. Everybody liked our hillbilly music. We had a guy from Ducky called Kane Tuck. He was a comedian and a singer and a guitar player. Then another one from Kentucky played the steel guitar. One from Texas played bass fiddle, and then one from Louisiana played the lead guitar, and I played the fiddle. We got along pretty good in the German Reserve. They gave us one building to put on our shows and things, and we put on the Grand Ole Opera because it bombed out a place in Vienna, and they gave us the theater, all the beautiful dresses and makeup. We had guys in there that knew how to use it, and we dressed them up like women, and they made them up look like women. and we put on square dances for them. And those Germans were there in the front two rows. They sat there and clapped and pounded their feet, and they enjoyed that as much as Americans. But we put on a show 10 nights running like that, and some of the guys wouldn't get to see the show because the same guy's coming back every night. Then we supposed to have a contract with Grand Ole Opera back in Nashville when we came out, and we went in fire direction. Nobody stayed together.
Well, it's too. I'm imagining that you're probably one of the only guys left from, what you call them, the barbed-wired mountaineers?
Yeah, barbed-wired mountaineers.
When's the last time you played the fiddle?
Close to 70 years ago. Very close. I came home, I played for a few places. You might not remember, but over at 99 and Manning, there was a place called the Nightclub, Texas Monitor Playboy. I played there. Played for a couple of places here in Orange Cove. And they wanted me to play down in Bakersfield, those guys, Buck Owen, that whole bunch. I quit. I said, no, I'm through with that. And I walked out on it.
Well, and maybe some people think it sounds a little silly to be playing the fiddle and doing all this music in a prison camp when you're starving to death, you're freezing to death, and guys are dying, and you don't know what's happening in the war. But how big a deal was that for you, and what did it mean to have something that could take your mind off the rest of things?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a big relief. I enjoyed playing, and we had a lot of fun out of it, and it passed the time, and as you say, it took our mind off what was going on, but go to bed, realistic things hit back.
Yeah. Did your family know where you were?
Eventually, yes. I wrote home and got correspondence between home and different people I knew. They let us write out and get letters back in. Of course, they censored everything. But that, and then some of my relation, they tried to send me stuff, and I'd get something here and there. I wrote home and told them, send me some chewing tobacco. And they sent me a carton of that, and I didn't use it. I traded it to guys for food. Boy, the guys are crazy to get that.
Entrepreneurial spirit, I like it. Are there any other stories that stand out as far as the ingenuity of POWs, something that you guys were able to make out of nothing, or some great ideas that you saw people come up with that helped the rest of you?
Not really. I had a few incidents that I remember stand out in my mind, though. Like when the fleas got so bad in all that straw, the Germans came in and they took that out and burned it, and they brought in new straw, the bales, large, enormous bales, and they stopped them out in the company street. And that's two guys that helped me get the blankets. I said, let's go get a bale of that straw and make our beds. Said, you crazy? They're standing there with the guards with bayonets fixed all around it. I said, well, they think we're on detail. They won't think anything about it. So let's go. So we went out and we got a hold of that one of those bales. All three of us could do was pick it up. The guard stepped back. Sure enough, just like we supposed to do it, which nobody told us to. Mm-hmm. And all we could do is drag and pick that bale of straw up. We got it in the back end of our barrack. We made our bunk and give the rest to the other guys. Then that's always kind of stood out in my mind.
You just acted like you knew what you were doing and they didn't notice, huh?
Right. One time, run through a barrack, I fell. Right straight and gamma, and got up, boy, the bayonets, a solid row of them on both sides of the walk, all the way around the barrack out in Company Street. Tripod set up on each end of the street with a machine gun. Guy sitting there in the middle with the table. Picture number check. They was after a Russian pilot we had hit out in there. They never did find him. But it was kind of scary to walk out through that. You didn't know what was going to happen, because one time I was laying there in our bunks and the bullets started whizzing through it. There's two guys, I knew them. They went out through the back, crawling through the snow trying to escape. And they killed those two. And there's two others running our barracks. And they shooting at him, and the bullets are coming through there. We hit the floor. One guy hit him right in the rectum. And they took him up to the hospital. Never did hear. I guess he died. Never did hear about him. But there's several incidents like that. And had one lieutenant there empty his little pea shooter and run. They'd march us up a hill there to take a shower. Well, they'd turn the warm water on before you'd soak down. They'd turn the cold water back on you. Well, we sneaking off, about four or five of us, and this officer caught us. He stood there and he run every round of ammunition he had out on the ground, jumping up and down, hand charging that little old gun, trying to shoot us. We took off, we got in formation. But when the weather would permit, and the pipes would thaw out in between the barracks there, we'd turn it on and run back and forth through that ice water and finally get to where you could take it and take a fast shower. That was the way we got about, and that wasn't very often. You couldn't wash your clothes or anything. When we did, in the wintertime, you couldn't because it'd freeze up on you. It was cold, and my toes, I had frostbite, both feet, and my ankles down felt like wood. Go out, and they'd make you stand in that ice and snow and cold. If somebody messed up and didn't fall out when they should, they punished everybody, made you stand out there in that cold for another hour or so. And my toes got so they broke open across the top chilblains and wept. And that was the most miserable thing that I had. But icicles from the roof down to the ground formed in front of your window. And they talked about sunny Austria. I was wondering where it was at.
Not where you were. You're describing these conditions, and I'm sure people are listening and saying, boy, I don't know if I could have survived that. Did you have days where your hope dwindled, where you weren't sure if you were going to survive?
No, really. I still had hope all through it. I knew at any time it could end, but I thought if anybody was going to make it, I would be one of them.
Where did that come from? What was the source of that hope?
I don't know. It wasn't a religious belief. It's just not that I was against religion or anything, because I was raised in the Bible Belt, Baptist back there. But I had hopes that if anybody made it, I'd go into. But there's one thing that I wanted. That fiddle I was playing, an old Austrian brought it in, and they'd put it back, and nobody picked it up. And one I was playing, the neck warped on it. And I went in there, and I picked that old fiddle up, and I dusted it off, strung it up. I looked down the bottom, it had been branded 1713. And if I left a note in that thing, if somebody would send it to me and where to send it here in the States, I'd send them a nice reward. And if I got it here, just like that Strad here a while back, they found worth tens of millions. That was older than that Strad was. It's a 1740 model. And this the one that I played, 1713. And that thing had the best tone to it. It almost played itself.
Well, maybe that's the next chapter here. Maybe we can hunt this thing down. So you're saying this violin was built in 1713. At least that's how it was marked. But you had to leave it behind when you guys were forced out of the camp?
That's correct. But you know, the guys that stayed in the hospital, we talked, and I got to Le Havre. Some of them made it to Le Havre while I was there. And anyway, the one that I talked to said, yeah, they dropped, the RAF came over that night, and they dropped firebombs. One hit right outside where you slept. And if they did, that fiddle violin went up.
But you left a little slip of paper in it, or what?
A note. I put it down inside of it.
And what did it say?
If anyone should send me this to this address, I will send you a nice reward for it.
So you know you left it there. You know that was an address, but you don't know if that fiddle survived the bombing.
No, that's correct. I didn't want to take it out in the weather and sleet and rain, because we walked 18 days on the 4th March right down the Danube.
Yeah, and we're going to hear about that 18-day march when we come back. If you'd like to hear Orville playing the fiddle, I have a little video of that for you on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You heard him say he hadn't played in nearly 70 years, but he was kind enough to humor his new friend Les Beck and me before we left his home in Orange Cove. Check out that video. And as far as the mystery of the violin he left behind at Stalag 17B, after a little research, I learned that Germany, in the early 1900s, mass-produced copies of 18th-century violins, stamping them with the year of the model that they were copying. So it's possible that it could have been one of those reproductions, or, you never know, an original from 1713. But if you happen to find a 70-year-old note from a prisoner of war named Orville Lewis inside your violin, let me know. That would make for quite a reunion. And speaking of reunions, you can imagine our POW friend was looking forward to seeing his family again. But he'd enjoy even another reunion before that. And he'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
From the creators of Courageous and Fireproof comes War Room, a powerful new film about fighting life's battles in prayer.
This is my favorite place in this house. I call it my war room.
Because prayer is a powerful weapon. War Room, now playing. Starring Alex Kendrick, Priscilla Shirer, and Beth Moore.
We need an army of believers. Raise them up, Lord. Raise them up.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. Tickets and showtimes available now at warroomthemovie.com.